Okay, the departure of Dennis Kucinich removes an iconic figure from Congress, but with all due respect, that is nothing compared to the change people are facing in Indianapolis. Peyton Manning, the Indianapolis Colts quarterback, was released after 14 years and a Super Bowl title. His absence last season due to injury only underlined Manning's value. The team collapsed without him, had an appalling season. Yesterday, though, the Colts let him go rather than make a big contract payment. Fans braced for the news during lunch hour, including at the Indianapolis Colts Grill.
And we put the sound on the press conference, and it was dead silence.
Scott Mossbarger is manager at the restaurant. He says customers crowded in to watch Manning say goodbye.
And then after he was done, everybody gave him a round of applause inside the restaurant, and we put some music on after the press conference to lighten the mood a little bit.
Colts fans do have good reason to be excited about the future. The Colts are now free to draft a rookie quarterback who is sometimes called the best prospect since Peyton Manning. And Manning himself will seek employment from another team. NPR's Mike Pesca lends some perspective to an NFL personnel matter that's widely being described as the end of a glorious era.
The Greek lyric poet Pindar wrote of the Elysian fields and an afterlife where men, swift in strength and supreme in wisdom, spend their days on the island of the blessed. We, too, speak of fields of glory for our modern generals once their time with the current army has come to pass. We call this status not Elysium, but finding an AFC East team with some salary cap room. Anyway, yesterday, two men in somber suits wept over their shared predicament. First, Colts owner Jim Irsay.
You know, growing up together in the organization, when a 37-year-old owner met a 22-year-old player coming out of Tennessee, and the dreams that we had and experienced are just beyond my imagination.
Next was Peyton Manning's turn to choke back tears.
It truly has been an honor to play in Indianapolis. I do love it here. I love the fans, and I will always enjoy having played for such a great team.
Following the press conference, pundits blitz the airwaves to sing the praises of Peyton. ESPN has recently hired former Colts general manager Bill Polian, who is a bit choked up by the affair himself.
I think for all of us around the country watching that, wherever we might have been, it was extremely emotional because it was the end of a glorious era.
Hundreds of thousands line the sidewalks, and among them, many in tears. Humanitarian and champion of democracy, he had won the hearts of millions.
Sorry, that was an old newsreel talking about FDR, not Peyton Manning. But such was the tone of the flood of coverage of this announcement. ESPN's NFL reporter Adam Schefter, in detailing the next steps, sounded a little like a funeral director laying out instructions to the bereaved.
It's official, Bob. A short time ago, the Colts announced the unthinkable, that they officially had released Peyton Manning. And what will happen is his name will show up on the waiver wire about 4 o'clock when it goes out to NFL teams. And once that happens, let the bidding begin.
Unthinkable, except for the fact that this eventuality was all anyone in the NFL has been talking about since before the Super Bowl. In the Indianapolis Star, the headline for this set of events was Shared Pain for Manning, Irsay, and a City. Just as factual would have been, wealthy boss denies historically well-compensated employee future riches. Peyton Manning has made about $175 million as a Colt. His endorsements are worth about $15 million a year. He was to be paid around $35 million this year after missing all of last season with a neck injury, this with the Colts lined up to draft Andrew Luck, the best quarterback in college. While Colts fans surely do feel a loss, the split between player and team was mutual and, quite likely, mutually beneficial. Andrew Brandt, a former NFL executive now with the National Football Post, doesn't discount the emotions, but thinks some optimism's in order.
Manning thinks he can get a similar financial situation somewhere else with a fresh start. Irsay thinks he's got the replacement at a fraction of the cost.
Yesterday afternoon, the media played the Symphony of Peyton Manning as if the sheet music called for a crescendo. Really, it was just a rest between measures. Andrew Brandt says in the NFL, moments of repose take less time than a Peyton Manning-led fourth-quarter drive.
You know, you have people leave a press conference, go back to their desk, and what's on their to-do list?
For the Colts, it's build one franchise, and for Manning, it's jumpstart another. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
The This is definitely NPR News.
Adam Wolfberg had two young daughters when his wife Kelly went into labor with their third child. It was not a joyous occasion. The baby was 3 months early. After just 26 weeks in the womb, their baby daughter, Larissa, entered the world by emergency C-section and was whisked into the neonatal intensive care unit of a Boston hospital. It's the same hospital where Dr. Wolfberg was doing his medical residency in obstetrics and gynecology. His background was a mixed blessing.
Sometimes I think a little bit of knowledge is a scary thing because we knew enough to be terribly worried, but not really enough to understand the nuance of what was to come. And certainly our knowledge didn't give us any tools to do anything about it.
In his new book, Fragile Beginnings, Adam Wolfberg describes seeing his daughter, 1 pound, 15 ounces, a breathing tube down her throat.
Quickly, she was wrapped in stickers that were connected to monitors. Then she was wrapped in a very, very small little diaper and placed in this plexiglass box that would keep her warm. It was a quite striking arrival and a scary sight when I was able to visit with her a couple hours after she was born.
In his book, Fragile Beginnings, Wolfberg tells the story of babies like Larissa, born too soon, and how much has changed for these tiny patients over the last century.
Early on in the history of taking care of premature babies, there were these odd spectacles in amusement parks, including one in Coney Island, where doctors had fashioned primitive incubators to care for these small babies. And people who were coming to see shows and ride rides would also come and gaze through these windows at babies in incubators. And some of the admission fees paid to get into these amusement parks helped to support early medical efforts to save premature babies.
But decades more would go by before real progress was made. And it's interesting and also quite sad that there was one birth in particular that seems to have galvanized the field, and that was the birth of John F. and Jacqueline Kennedy's premature baby.
President Kennedy's baby, Patrick, was born prematurely with a problem breathing that today would be trivial. It would be cared for with the assistance of medicines and equipment that are routine in any hospital in the United States and in most hospitals around the world. But in this case, the knowledge and the technology didn't exist. And in spite of heroic efforts, this baby passed away after only a couple of days of life.
I know you say heroic, but as I read it, it seemed like there was really nothing much they could do for him.
The technology at their disposal was extremely limited, and I think that Patrick's birth and death galvanized the medical community in a way that no other premature baby had to that point to really tackle some of these problems and allow kids like Patrick to survive.
Now, this would have been in the early 1960s. Over the last 50 years, enormous progress has been made. Just pick one innovation that's happened in recent years and tell us how it came about and what a huge difference it made.
I think that the story of the development of surfactant is fascinating. This is a compound that allows the lungs, which would normally collapse, to remain open. And surfactant was the result of research done in the middle of the night by a young Harvard researcher named Mary Ellen Avery. She was studying lung disease and found this froth coming from the mouth and really from the lungs of adults with heart failure, and wondered whether that froth, which turned out to contain this critical compound surfactant, wasn't the piece that was missing from her premature newborn charges who were unable to breathe after they were born. And her research led to the creation of an artificial surfactant that, again, has been life-saving.
Well, your daughter, Larissa, did well the first day, but then she experienced a massive bleeding in the brain. It must be one of the most frightening things that can happen to a premature baby because it signals all kinds of potential problems ahead.
that in some ways was our greatest concern, because a significant bleed in the brain commonly leads to a walking or movement problem known as cerebral palsy and other long-term neurologic complications.
You write about the decisions that doctors and patients make about the treatment of an extremely preterm newborn and how it can have profound implications for the child's future. Is there a debate taking place about asking for everything to be done?
I think that some of these physicians have seen babies with profound injuries grow up to lead extremely impaired lives. And I think that physicians worry that by doing absolutely everything when the long-term outcome is so much a question mark, that maybe they aren't making the right decision, or maybe they aren't providing the right counsel to those parents all of the time.
Let's talk about your daughter, Larissa. How has she fared?
Larissa just turned 10, and she has done remarkably well, unexpectedly well. She has some minor impairment in her gait, and her right hand doesn't work as well as her left hand does. But she is a funny, joyful kid with absolutely no cognitive impairment whatsoever. Considering Larissa's injury at birth, we are absolutely the luckiest parents alive.
Dr. Wolfberg, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
Adam Wolfberg is the author of Fragile Beginnings, Discoveries and Triumphs in the Newborn ICU. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Now, you've heard that European governments have a little debt problem. But right now, the banks in Europe have plenty of money. A mere 6 months ago, people were talking about which banks were going to collapse. Zoe Chace of NPR's Planet Money team has the story of how those banks almost sank the European economy until they got a massive infusion of cash.
How much cash? $1.7 trillion. Who's got that kind of money on hand in Europe? Only one place, the European Central Bank. You might remember a couple of years ago when the U.S. banks were in trouble. Our central bank, the Federal Reserve, poured money into the banking system. Almost $1 trillion, actually. But that was the height of the financial crisis. The European Central Bank just did this last week. It's a pretty dramatic thing to do. And to figure out why they took such a big step, let's go to the coast of Spain, to a bar in Marbella.
I have a little bar, a drinks bar, in the port of Marbella. And just sun, sand, and sea.
It's just kind of empty at the moment.
It is.
Chad Rittenbaugh's American, but he lives in coastal Spain, and he owns and runs this bar, El Catalonia. He bought it during tough times, 2009.
The bottom fell out again in 2010, just kept going lower again in 2011.
Bad situation getting worse. Chad was like, I got to get out of here. So he decides to sell the bar, but there's a problem.
Nobody's out buying bars right now. And I think in part because banks are just not lending a cent, a euro cent.
People kept telling him over and over, I can't get a loan from a Spanish bank. And this made sense to Chad. After all, he'd tried to get a loan too.
Just like 40,000 euros. Couldn't lend us anything. We'd say, you know, it was almost comical. We'd, well, how about 20? How about 10? No, no, no. How about 5? No. Absolutely nothing.
This was happening all over Europe. European banks have been hoarding their money. Why? Because last year, as the European debt crisis grew worse and worse, banks were looking nervously at what was supposed to be their safest loans, their most popular loans, loans to the government. Those loans on their books, they weren't worth so much anymore. And the banks had made a lot of them. So European banks started worrying about bankruptcy. Economist Luis Garicano remembers what happened next.
People start to worry about the state. Oh, my goodness, this state is going to have to rescue these banks, and these banks are big and bad.
The state couldn't help the banks. The banks couldn't help the state. Nobody had any money. Nobody's lending. Everybody's broke. except for the European Central Bank. But for months, as things got worse and worse, the ECB said, no, we can't. A, it's not our job to prop up banks. And B, pumping all this new money into the banks to solve a debt problem, that's a recipe for inflation. The European governments got pretty uptight waiting for help from their central bank. They made some big promises about how they were going to get out of debt. Finally, right around Christmas Eve, the European Central Bank turned on the faucet. They actually didn't make a big deal out of it at the time. They just said, hey, if you need a cheap loan, we'll give it to you.
It does solve the problem of how am I going to finance myself tomorrow morning.
Luis Garicano says European banks drank that money in. It plugged the holes on their balance sheets, but it wasn't enough. And last week, the ECB doubled down. They made a whole second round of loans available to thirsty European banks. But it hasn't yet made its way to a tiny bar on the coast of Spain. The banks have mostly kept it for themselves and for their governments. And our poor bartender, he's stuck.
I keep hearing the same stories that nobody can borrow any money.
But remember, this just happened. The new loans from the ECB money might make their way down into the real economy soon. To the bars in Spain, as well as the banks. Zoe Chace, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, how do you get a celebrated but rather ill-tempered rock drummer to sit down long enough to open up about his music and his wild past? It takes nerve and, let's say, a creative approach to the truth. We'll talk with the director of a new documentary about Ginger Baker, the legendary drummer of the rock group Cream. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we want to look at the ethical challenges facing two of America's favorite brands. NFL officials are still dealing with the bounty system scandal. Defensive coordinator Greg Williams reportedly organized a system to funnel payments to his players, to injure opposing players, even to knock them out of games. And then there's the public relations hit that Apple has suffered recently. Despite the big reveal yesterday of a new iPad, there are lingering questions about the factories that create their products. Regardless of how the league or company bosses respond, we were thinking about, what about us, you and me, and everybody who watches pro football or depends upon that iPhone or iPad. We were thinking, what's the fan or customer's role in all this? To talk about this, we've called upon Jack Marshall. He's been with us before. He's the president and founder of ProEthics. That's an ethics consulting group. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Now, you know, you actually have been thinking about this for quite some time. I saw a column that you wrote back in 2009 when the news about the physical toll that football may play on players' brains long after they stop playing the game, when that information started coming to light. And you recently wrote another blog titled The NFL Battling Its Own Sick Culture. So are you saying that you are at a point where you just don't think it's ethical to watch the game at all?
I think it's getting to that point, like it did with boxing. People forget that boxing at one point was really arguably the number one sport in our country until gradually the public started realizing that they were directly involved in two men beating each other, often sometimes to death. But you know, we have had to watch a beautiful human being like Muhammad Ali go through the last many years, obviously suffering from the results of this.
But you said that, simply put, it is wrong to pay money to persuade people to permanently damage themselves for our entertainment.
I think that's true, and I think to a great extent, football fans try not to think about that. You know, when you're watching football on television, it doesn't appear that these people are being crippled. We don't see how hard they hit each other. And when one of the things that was fascinating was the reaction of other players to this bounty scandal, they all sort of shrugged and said, well, that's the game. It's always been that way. We are trying to cripple each other.
This is something that sports writer Dave Zirin said on this program, you know, earlier in the week when we were talking about this. Here's what he said.
The repercussions for the post-playing career of an NFL player is just so horrific. And I think that this is a way of saying, hey, we're serious about violence, when at the end of the day, it is a violent sport. And that's what the league and its fans need to come to terms with.
Well, he wasn't willing to go right there. But other sports writers, like LA Times sports writer T.J. Simers, wrote a column that essentially called out people who were outraged about this. He says, you're just hypocrites, that the violence is what people want to see. And the other people argue, look, people do this voluntarily. You're not conscripted into football. You know, this is not a draft system where you are forced to do this for the benefit of the state or whatever. And if it's your choice, why should people be unable to watch it if it's also their choice?
It's my choice not to participate in it. I mean, the analogy I always think of is like paying drunks to dance or paying people to hurt themselves. I mean, I think it's both unethical and immoral to pay people to hurt themselves. Everybody will have a price, and they may feel now when they're crippling themselves that it's a good buy. But later on, when their families have to care for them, when they're in their 50s and they're we don't even know the extent of this, but a lot of these former players are suffering premature dementia and simply can't function. Do fans really want to confront the fact that the argument for this is they're happy for us to pay them to cripple themselves, ergo we shouldn't care about it? If they want to do that, that's fine. I don't want to be complicit in that. And if I'm paying them, if I'm among the people giving them their reinforcement by cheering and by giving them the money to harm themselves, I'm complicit in it.
We're talking about the ethics, the ethical question around this alleged bounty system where NFL players were allegedly paid to injure opponents, even to the point of taking them out of the game. My guest is ethicist Jack Marshall. He's the president and founder of Pro Ethics, and we consult with him from time to time on these questions. I want to wheel around in the time we have left to this whole question of Apple, one of the also very popular brand. The products are beloved. I mean, I don't think that's too much. I don't think that's exaggerating. Apple unveiled the new iPad yesterday, and this comes after reports of very poor working conditions in Chinese factories manufacturing Apple products. And so the question has now arisen, you know, what do you do as a consumer? If now that you know, you can't say, okay, I didn't know about this. But now that you do know, what do you think that customers should do? Because there are others who say, look, do you really want to deprive these Chinese workers have the opportunity to improve their standard of living by making these products, and that the work will just go someplace else. So what do you think consumers who care about this should do?
This is something related to the dilemma you were talking to with Mr. Kristof, which is a matter of, as a nation that cares about human rights, can we just say that you know, when in Rome, we'll do as the Romans do, and if they happen to not care about human rights as much as we do, then we should put our conscience on the shelf when we're working with them. I think that in the case of Apple, those who are going to purchase their products, if they care about this, then they need to be saying to the company, you need to raise the standards set the new standards in those countries, make sure that they meet at least minimal standards of fair treatment and fair labor practices, even if this may be way above the norm in that particular country. Therefore, we can exercise some beneficial cultural influence. It may mean that we may have to pay more for our Apple iPads in the future, and that Apple may have to take a little less of a profit. But again, all of these things, back to the NFL, we have to sacrifice if we're going to stand up for standards.
Do you have one or two?
I don't have. No,
you don't have any Apple products?
I don't have any Apple products.
Why not?
I haven't bought any yet.
Well, you could have one without buying it. Somebody might give you one.
Yeah, I mean,
is it the issue of the ethics, or you just don't care for them?
No, it is. It's neither. I probably would accept one, but I'd have to focus at it after a point of view. I mean, I think Apple deserves time to adjust. I think this is a problem as our entire economic system moves into international areas. We have to figure out how much we're willing to sacrifice.
Obviously, a rich discussion. I bet we'll have a lot of comments about your comments today, and we'll look forward to those. Jack Marshall is the president and founder of Pro Ethics, an ethics consultancy group, and he was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Once again, thank you.
Thank you.